Radio News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. An adversary, but also a potential partner. That's part of how President Obama described China in the final presidential debate, summing up the complex relationship between the countries with the world's two largest economies. It's a connection often characterized by competition and sometimes confrontation. The two nations differ vocally on trade policy and human rights, among other issues. The U.S. talks regularly about China needing to play by the rules in the economic world. Leaders in Beijing repeatedly call on America to stay out of what it calls internal affairs. But despite the sometimes tough talk, the two sides are deeply connected as trading partners and as major voices on international issues, from the Eurozone debt crisis to North Korea. This is a unique moment to look at this unique relationship. In the U.S., China policy was one of the few foreign policy issues to get any traction during the presidential campaign. China, meanwhile, is in the midst of its own leadership change as President Hu Jintao draws his decade in power to a close and a new leader, Xi Jinping, begins his tenure. Today on The Exchange, the China challenge, the U.S.-Chinese relationship going forward, and we'd like to hear from you. Do you do business with China, or have you traveled there? What have you seen about the way these two countries relate and interact? What issues do you care most about when it comes to China and the United States, and how do you think the U.S. government should approach those issues? Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. Our guest for the hour, Chris Reardon, Associate Professor of Political Science and Chair of the Department of Political Science at UNH. He specializes in Chinese domestic and foreign politics, international relations, and international political economy. Chris Reardon, great to have you.
Oh, good morning.
And with us also, Lu Yan, Associate Professor in the Department of History at UNH. She's a native of Shanghai, specializes in modern Chinese history, particularly the transformation of Chinese culture and society, as well as Chinese-Japanese relations. And Lu Yan, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Nice to be here.
Let's start with this presidential race, because as I mentioned, it was foreign policy, not a huge piece of the campaign, but it did play a role, and the issues relating to China did come up throughout the campaign. So, Chris Reardon, I'll start with you. What does the campaign rhetoric that we heard around China in election 2012 tell us about the true state of the relationship between U.S. and China at this point?
I don't think it tells you anything, because that when you're doing conducting a political campaign, you're more concerned about trying to get across simplistic ideas. And I think both for the president and for candidate Romney, that both of them fell back into certain concepts that sounds like it's they're relatively simple, that the Chinese are basically a threat, and that the currency, there's instability, that there's competition, unfair competition. Well, all of these things are true, but they mask this overall sense of cooperation that the U.S. and China have really been developing since we established relations with the Chinese in 1979. So from what I can see, that you're absolutely correct that foreign policy was not a major element in the previous campaign. However, that doesn't mean that foreign policy, especially our relationship with China, is not important. And I think that President Obama Governor Romney both would agree that perhaps one of our most important relationships is and will be with the Chinese state. And despite what the might have been said about moving all of our jobs, Jeep moving their productions to China and all this other rhetoric and let's say misinformation, you have to push that aside and realize that whoever is in the leadership in Washington as well as the leadership in Beijing, they both understand how important this relationship is.
So, Lu Yan, a lot of rhetoric and maybe characterizing the relationship as more contentious than it actually is, that there may be more cooperation that we're just not hearing about during an election year.
It's probably for the benefit of election rather than substance. In terms of foreign relations, as a China watcher, I tend to think there will be a lot more continuity whoever comes to the office, rather than how they argued during the election. Mm.
So you don't see the Chinese leadership hearing this talk about China trade and bringing cases to the World Trade Organization is necessarily going to be something that comes up going forward. They'll just recognize it as this is campaign talk, and then now the election's over, we'll get back to business.
Even though it's part of the campaign talk, the dispute over certain products, about the tax or government subsidies, are the issues already been going on, and it will continue. Mm. So that's what I mean by continuity in foreign relations rather than abrupt change.
Well, let's just talk broadly then about the deep connection between these two economies. Chris Reardon, we know that the president brought up during the campaign that he was bringing more cases to the World Trade Organization about China than his predecessor, President Bush, has done. But in the broader context, that's a rather low number. There's just such a huge economic relationship that goes beyond those particular cases of concern between the two countries.
When China joined the WTO in 2001, there was a recognition that China would gradually adhere to international norms of behavior, and that there was a very set process in which gradually the Chinese economy would become more internationalized. They would reduce supports for domestic industries. They would open up parts of the economy. And many of these things have occurred. Some of them have not. On the other hand, we have lots of areas here in the United States in which we are very protectionist of our industries. Part of the WTO is one in which countries are dealing with one of the most sensitive areas, trade, because trade deals is involved with jobs. And both in the United States and in China, jobs is a primary concern of the leadership. So that both sides need to make sure that they're being treated fairly, and that there's a level playing field. There's always going to be a sense of disagreement. The point is here that now they have this formal institution in which they take their discussions. They don't take it to the streets. They take it behind closed doors in Geneva. They have these discussions. They have these investigations. And then they come out with a resolution. And that's how cooperation takes place. It's not that everybody is going to say, oh, we're going to adhere to all the rules, so forth. You have to follow this. And both sides are doing that. And they're making sure that we're playing by the rules.
And something that we should talk about, too, as well, Luyan, is that the dynamic between the two countries is changing at the same time that each of their economies is changing. So the relationship that the U.S. and China had as economic powers 30 years ago, or even 10 or 15 years ago, is different now because China's economy has changed so much in that time.
Very much so. About 20 years or even 10 years, the situation was very, very different. Mm. And especially with the exchange rate between U.S. dollar and the Chinese yen changed so much. There's a change about one-third, I think, that gives probably a larger, bigger purchasing power for the Chinese. Mm-hmm. So we are going to see a lot more Chinese people coming to this country, and they are actually coming in tens of thousands, probably. I don't have the figure, but you see more and more Chinese tourists coming to this country. And there will be a great deal and a deeper contact between the two societies, not just in terms of countries. It's more than international relations, but more on the level of person-to-person and culture-to-culture encounters. And there certainly will be more problems, but the problems that will be dealt with not by leaders only, but by individual ordinary people.
And we're going to continue to talk about that relationship, the culture-to-culture relationship that grows between the two countries. But before we do that, I want to invite our listeners to call in with their questions and comments. The exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Chris Reardon, let me ask you just about a few of these economic issues that did come up in the campaign, and sort of the one that you mentioned, the one about jobs going to China, which came up in the final weeks, but also this issue that Republican nominee Mitt Romney brought up about currency manipulation. And he talked about if he were elected, that on day one, he would label China as a currency manipulator, going back to that international economic structure that both countries are now a part of. President Obama did not say he would do that, and it doesn't appear that that's going to happen. Where does that leave that issue then going forward?
Okay, well, first I would say that the United States, since the early 1980s, has been a primary supporter of China opening its economy to the outside world, that we have seen this as a way for China to become more involved with the rest of the global economy, and the idea that the more they're involved, the more they want to cooperate with everyone, and for both to benefit the Chinese people, it will improve their livelihoods, and that's exactly what has happened. What we also have to understand is that part of this involvement means that there have been quite a few American companies that have moved their operations from the United States or from Taiwan and other places to mainland China, where they've set up wholly owned invested enterprises. They're making their goods, whether they're tennis rackets or their clothes or their various electronic goods, coming back, selling them all over the United States at relatively cheap prices, because of at that time, especially in the 90s and in past 10 years, the cost of production in China has been relatively low. So we have really benefited from this. And so during the election campaign, it's true that jobs have left the United States, but this has been something that's been going on for a very long time, as we have becoming a far more high technology intensive country, and finding that labor costs and management costs and all these other types of costs that investors are always concerned about are cheaper in China. So when it comes to currency, this issue has been one in which we've had to discuss with the Chinese. They have allowed the currency to be pegged to the dollar anymore. And so now, instead of eight yuan,
we're just
going to
have to pick up after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And more on the China Challenge on The Exchange. And at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. domestic shale oil boom and geopolitical power. President Obama holds his first news conference in 8 months. NHPR will have live coverage for you beginning at 1:20 this afternoon. New Hampshire weather today becoming partly to mostly sunny, highs 42 to 47 degrees. Tonight clear to partly cloudy, lows near 20 across the North Country, ranging to around 30 in parts of southern New Hampshire. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Comcast Business Class, provider of internet, voice, TV, and Ethernet solutions that keep pace with the growth of your business. More information at 800-501-6000. And from Sulloway & Hollis, providing effective representation for estate planning, domestic relations, and family-owned businesses throughout New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, the political and economic relationship between China and the United States. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477, or send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our website, nhpr.org, or on the Exchange page on Facebook. We're talking with Chris Reardon, Associate Professor of Political Science and Chair of the Department of Political Science at UNH, and Liu Yan, Associate Professor in the Department of History at UNH. They're both members of UNH's Asian Studies faculty. And just before the break, Chris Reardon, we were talking about that issue of Chinese currency, and you were saying that that the issue is a lot more complex simply than saying Chinese manipulation of currency equals fewer jobs in the United States.
The Chinese yuan is becoming a major currency, and it is not fully convertible, but it is gradually becoming convertible. And what has happened is that there was a discrepancy before when the yuan was pegged to the dollar, the exchange rate went as high about 8 yuan to the dollar. And it was a great time for a foreigner to be in China. But over the past couple of years, especially as both the United States and Europeans and its foreign partners are complaining about the value, the realization the Chinese financial officials realize that the currency has to become more internationalized, they have switched from this pegging the yuan to the dollar to a multi they're using various currencies to determine the value of the renminbi, which has now dropped to about 6.2 or so yuan, which makes it more expensive for a foreigner with dollars to buy things, and allows the Chinese to buy more things overseas. And that's when Professor Lu Yan was just talking about more Chinese going abroad, and they are using that stronger currency. Of course, that makes their goods a bit more expensive, which is continuation. This is not something brand new. We saw this across the board in Asia throughout the 1960s and 70s, 80s, as countries began to develop up that ladder of going from high labor-intensive goods to more technology-intensive. The exchange rates also changed too, and that they began to become more mature economies.
And this is a question. Oh, go ahead, Lu Yan.
I want to add something to what Chris mentioned about the currency issue. I think this currency exchange rate between U.S. dollar and the Chinese yuan is repeating the similar trajectory as it happened some 30 or 40 years ago during the 1970s, that United States pressured Japanese government when there was a larger trade imbalance, and the Japanese yen had to appreciate, and the U.S. dollar depreciated as a means to readjust the trade balance. And as the result, you see the same trend. During the 80s, you see a lot of Japanese tourists coming to this country. And then in late 80s, early 90s, there continued to be trade imbalance. And there was a great deal of tension at the grassroots against Japanese imports. And there are some incidents happened, such as that happened in the in Detroit area, right, when some Chinese Americans were killed in the restaurant. So that could go to—
They were killed because they thought they were Japanese.
They were thought
Japanese.
As Japanese, right. But I hope a similar thing would not happen at grassroots, although we could feel that fear of Chinese taking the job and getting a lot more imports to this country. But I think currency exchange rate is somewhat double-edged sword, because if you watch what the Chinese exported into this country, the quality of Chinese goods, probably in my view, as I shop in Walmart very often, the quality of Chinese imports during that time, say maybe in the early 2000s, was much better than what we get now. Mm. Of course, there is also a shift of where to get overseas products. Now more and more we get products from Indonesia, Thailand, India probably, and maybe Peru as well. Mm-hmm. So companies shifted their overseas.
A much more broad economic picture for the global system. Right. Now, we've done a pretty good job, I think, outlining what the U.S. concerns are about China and its economy. But what about the flip side, Lu Yan? What are China's concerns about the U.S. economy, and what are the issues that it would be concerned about going forward?
Sometimes I watch Chinese television, and often, in fact, I get sense of the society side from watching television sitcom. Mm. One of the scenario that comes often in their narrative was that there would be sudden impact, say, in the 1997 financial storm, and then again in 2007, both had severe impact on Chinese economy. You see, China also went down as well, but not so severely as we experienced here in the United States. And for the ordinary people, it would be the problem of companies close down and lay off people. And I know young people during 2007-2008 had difficulties getting jobs, especially for college graduates, because they regarded them highly and they paid a lot for going through college. Nowadays, you have to pay through college, not like 30, 40 years ago. The country, the state, provides you to go through college. College education then in the 70s was free. But now every family has to pay for their college, for their children's college education. So it was a big impact when the financial meltdown happened in 2007. And the young people in China couldn't get jobs. I would say I talked to some people at that time. Someone was looking for jobs in 2008. He said he was lucky to get an intern in a company. And a lot of his classmates couldn't get jobs. Probably the rate would go like 30%.
That's a concern that I hear a lot from people in this country. So I guess there's definitely one commonality there. Chris Reardon, what do you hear about Chinese concerns about the United States, the issues they would raise going forward?
I would like to add to this, because that this sensitivity to what is going on in the global economy is felt very strongly in mainland China, especially in the coastal areas that are so integrated into the international demands structure. And so I was actually last night, I was at the Red River Theater talking about a film that was called The Last Train Home, and it talked about the 2007-2008 economic problems and the impact on southern China in the Guangdong region, in Dongguan and Shenzhen and so forth. Well, you had when international demand dropped, you had these companies that stopped, that closed their doors, that workers were left without being paid, that you had a lot of debts that went throughout the entire system. They were not being – that it was really an amazing impact in that area. Now, the central government used their reserves to cushion the blow by investing heavily into the infrastructure. So you get the highways, you get the high the super trains that are now beginning to crisscross China.
Kind of basic Keynesian stimulus.
All that stimulus money that helped China get through this period with a lower growth rate of 7%, where we could barely even make 1%. But this still had an impact on the Chinese people, and that fear of not having jobs is one in which it's partly because of the integration with the global economy and the emphasis now that they need to be able to develop their own demand, their own economy, not be quite as dependent on the international the health of the international economy.
Today in The Exchange, the China Challenge. It's the world's second largest economy and the largest foreign holder of American debt. China's future is intertwined with the United States, even as the two countries differ on issues from trade to human rights. These differences made for campaign fodder in the presidential race. Meanwhile, China is undergoing its own change in leadership. We're looking at this complicated relationship on The Exchange, and we'd like to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR, an email exchange at nhpr.org. Since we mentioned the change in the economy, I also wanted to mention that there is a big change going on in the political structure of China right now, Liu Yan. The People's Congress, or the Communist Party's Congress, I'm sorry, is going on or is about to wrap up. Hu Jintao has been in power for about a decade, and now a new leader coming onto the scene, Xi Jinping. What do we know, first of all, about Xi Jinping, and what might that mean for China's economy and the relationship between these two countries?
in terms of China's leadership, we would call them as the fifth generation. In comparison to the first generation, the Mao Zedong, Zhou Enlai generation, the founding generation, and then Deng Xiaoping, we are familiar, the second generation. And then the following Deng Xiaoping would be the third generation, Jiang Zemin and Zhu Rongji, the names we probably have already forgotten. And the one following the Hu Jintao generation, or Wen Jiabao, who is the prime minister of China, we will have Xi Jinping, and probably, as it's been widely guessed, Li Keqiang is another person who might succeed Wen Jiabao as the prime minister. This generation, if you look at how old they are, they were born in 1950s.
So after the revolution.
After the founding generation founded the People's Republic. So they would be the generation, as the Chinese would call them, grown up under the red flag, grown up with the People's Republic. That also means they experienced all kinds of political movements that the People's Republic waged by the founding generation, especially the Cultural Revolution. For Xi Jinping, I checked the Chinese website. It's all from the official information that his father, we all know, is one among the founding generation. And he himself was sent to the countryside, in fact, to his home province in Shanxi province in northwest China during the Cultural Revolution, and stayed there probably for 5 or 6 years. And from there, he went to the local leadership and also entered the college and get some education in China's one of the best colleges in Beijing, trained in chemical engineering, as I remember. And then most of his career was spent in the government at different levels. First at the county level, next would be the provincial level. And he was posted in the north and then to south, if I remember correctly, in Fujian province, right? Mm-hmm. And also he was posted in Shanghai after 2007, mm-hmm. After there was some major leadership change directed by Chen Liangyu affair that our listeners probably are not familiar with, but right. It's mainly the accusation of Chen as the mayor mismanaged the retirement fund.
Right.
And the issue was probably the conflict between the central government and the local government. And I heard from one of the leaders at mid-level in Shanghai, from one of the colleges, she said, when I asked about Xi Jinping, she said, oh, Xi Jinping is very capable in managing the affairs afterwards and capable to convince Shanghai leaders to move on after they feel demoralized. And that was the impression I got. So in other words, this is a generation who had various experiences, not just from warfare, like the founding generation, or like the Deng Xiaoping's generation, that to lead China through a major shift from focused on internal affairs to globalization and to make the economy open. There are many, many different challenges. But this is a generation experienced all that, but in a position of assisting all these changes. Now, this generation is coming up to the leadership.
Mm. Chris, your thoughts about this new generation as it starts to take on challenges?
I think it's very important to understand the different generations, and that I completely agree. This fifth generation of leadership is one in which, as Liu Yan was pointing out, have had these various experiences. But you meet some of these people, including Liu Yan herself, that has experienced the Cultural Revolution, have experienced the China opening up to the outside. And These are people that, and I will just direct my comments to Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang and the others who are going to be the new leadership in the Standing Committee of the Political Bureau. These are people who are highly educated. They're we're moving a little bit away from technocrats. Li Keqiang has a PhD in economics from Peking University, but they are more concerned about growth. They're more concerned about social stability and a little bit less concerned about ideology. So they are a bit more practical, having gone through this experience from the watching what their parents went through and so forth. There's also another thing that's very interesting that's happening is that you have a within this fifth generation, you have some who are coming from a little bit more of a they're the sons and daughters of very important people. They're called the princelings. The princelings, right. And Xi Zhongxun was, as Lu Yan was talking about, one of the most important people during the 1940s and 50s, and was also responsible for the promoting Guangdong's opening in the 1980s, early 1980s. Now, his son gained experience in southern China in one of these open areas in the 1980s in Fujian province, which was given all types of special rights and privileges in 1980. He then was able to expand on that experience in outside of Shanghai in a province called Zhejiang, which is one of the most rich provinces of all of China that really in certain ways surpassed Guangdong in a period there and the type of foreign investment and so forth. And then, of course, taking over in Shanghai. Li Keqiang's experience in Henan and so forth was maybe a little bit more interesting, but he is with a PhD in economics. He has more of a representative of another group called from the Chinese Youth League. It's basically the Communist Youth League that the Communist Party leader of the 1980s, Hu Yaobang, was a member of this group. And then more recently, Hu Jintao is a member of this group. So that you've got two different types of people that are composing this new leadership that are coming in the next tomorrow that you'll be seeing them.
And we'll pick it up after a short break. We'll also take some of your calls here on The Exchange from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from ENH Power, offering New Hampshire residents coal-free and pure green electricity. More information online at enhpower.com. And from Republic New Hampshire's original certified local farm-to-table restaurant, breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily, Elm Street, Manchester, online at republiccafe.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
I'm Kate McNally, inviting you to join us for The Folk Show on Sunday nights here on the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio. It's mostly acoustic music, bluegrass, Celtic, traditional folk, and new music, too. We also feature live performances and feature albums during the 9 o'clock hour. Join us for The Folk Show, Sunday nights, 7 to 10 p.m. here on the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. We're talking today about the China Challenge. As the world's second largest economy and the largest foreign holder of American debt, China's future is intertwined with the United States, even as the two countries differ on issues from trade and human rights. Let's hear from you now at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guests are Chris Reardon and Lu Yan of the University of New Hampshire. And let's take a call now. We have Josh on the line from Berlin. Hi, Josh. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. And hello to your guests. I'd like to just, first off, just mention a couple of inaccuracies that I have heard, and if you'd hear me out, as I know you will, you might see where, like the Japan, there was a reference from one of your guests that the Japanese trade imbalance and whatnot, but it was made to put in a light that the Japanese made it so that They had all kinds of concessions to import their cards, and through many holding countries did not have to pay taxes, which gave them an immediately great advantage over our automakers. And what they did was they would have it so that if the American dealership set up over in Japan, you had to disassemble the car, put in Japanese-made pollution control devices, that by the time you were done jumping through all the hoops and the levels, your car had to be put out at two or three times the value that it would be at the United States, which made them virtually uncompetitive. And I'd also like to say, I went to school, college here in the 1970s, from 1972 onwards, and I remembered I went to a state school and I had to pay. And most of the people had that experience, unless you were exemplary, where you were able to, through one reason or another, get a scholarship. And the last thing, and I think this is very important with the situation with China, is that I've noticed virtually all of the Chinese people who come here, come onto our programs, are very, very careful, and I would say almost intimidated, not to say anything the slightest bit negative about the Chinese government or that would reflect negatively on the Chinese agenda. And I've noticed this is that the Americans are put at a very severe disadvantage, whereas China is let off. And the last thing I'll say is the mortgage industry. When the mortgage crisis was upon us, the Japanese government had invested umpteen numbers of hundreds of million dollars in the market. They demanded and got a reimbursement for all their losses, which, again, was not a level playing field, because the Americans who had invested, or the Germans, or the other government, or the French, or the other governments, they weren't given reimbursements. But I see China's government very demanding, very oppressive, and it intimidates its people so they will not say the slightest bit thing that could be misconstrued as to be a negative reflection on the Chinese government policies. And I believe this has to be introduced into the equation.
Okay, Josh, thanks for that call. A lot of points there, Liu Yan. But first, let's bring up that idea of China sort of projecting power out and possibly intimidating people to project a certain kind of image in the global community.
The term to connect with the world came up a few years ago. Probably I hear it from the Chinese television for maybe 3 or 5 years. In the Chinese term is 和国际接轨, it's the image of connecting two railroads, is to follow the international standard. When I hear that term, I can sense from the listener is that the Chinese were anxious to bring them up to the international standard in terms of technology, in terms of education, and even in terms of social security, because all these systems in China have to be built from scratch. They don't have social security for not until recently, and that money has been taken from people's salary and wages to be put aside as part of the social security and building the security net for the future. And all these systems are new for the Chinese. Before China opened up, it was very much supplied by the state in terms of health and medical care and education. But now it's all changed. And it's part of to connect to the world, to the international standard.
But in connecting to that, you don't feel necessarily that there is any kind of intimidation, that it's that the government is trying to get you to speak in a certain way or give a certain perspective about what it's been doing to as it connects to the world?
Uh-huh. For the Chinese government and for the Chinese people, even for both of them, the state and the society, I would sense a greater sense of anxiety. There was a term since the opening up of China, and through the 90s, there was a term very popular, spoken more and more by the leadership, that was this: to cross the river by touching the stone. Mm. That means everything is experiment. They didn't know what next step of policy and the change and the reform would bring up in a country so huge. It's more than a country; it's a continent, and the country is a great has a great deal of variety and the differences from what Chris mentioned, East Coast, which was connected to the world more closely than the central China and than the western China. Facing the Chinese government was to manage this huge country. And for the ordinary people is how the opening up and also the change of system brings everyday challenge in terms of food price, in terms of job security, and of course, now, China in the similar system, I think in terms of economy like America, you don't have guaranteed job. You don't have free education. You don't have free medical care. And you could lose your job very easily if there is a big storm globally. And China would be affected by that as well. Even you pay a high price for education, still you are not guaranteed to get a job. You have to find it, and you may lose it again. So the challenges was on both sides, for the government and for the ordinary people as well. So I would rather say they feel quite threatened by the uncertainty.
Chris Reardon, the as China moves into that role as a bigger player in the global picture, economically, of course, but in foreign policy circles as well, there has been this push in the last few years to project what's called soft power, trying to create those connections to other countries. But as we heard from our caller, the danger can be that you can project soft power and create a perception that your intentions are not necessarily peaceful or honorable.
Right. Let me just try and answer some of Josh's questions. That first, he was right about the Japanese advantages. That in the 1980s, Japanese automobiles just dominated the United States car market, especially after the oil crises of the 1970s. But we also have to admit that the Japanese were much better at making very efficient cars while we were making those clunkers. And it took Detroit a lot of time to change their technology to make cars that were halfway decent and to compete against the Japanese. Now, you know, the caller was talking about how the Japanese were forcing Americans to change the way that they were selling cars in Japan. Well, if you go to Japan, there are not that many American cars. That's true. If you go to Korea, there are not that many American cars. If you go to China today, you know, one of the most popular cars is GM. It's a very, very popular car. And the whole idea about the production of Jeeps being made by Chrysler. First, AMC, which was the original owner of Jeep, they set up Beijing Jeep a long time ago. They were one of the first joint ventures in China. And while its fortunes over the years have changed, Jeep production has been going on in China for a long time, and the global production system is far different, where you don't have a car that is completely made in the United States or completely made elsewhere. That so I think the caller needs to think about that the situation in the 1980s with Japan, the situation today with China is completely different. As for state education, I'm very, very happy to hear that he's a product of New Hampshire public education. I just hope he remembers, and I hope the legislature remembers that when they come to doling out money in the next budget, that the people in New Hampshire need to be educated about Asia and the rest. But I won't go on about that.
An issue that's certainly going to play out over the next few months.
Well, it's playing out in the university because we're having to tighten our belts.
We'll be keeping an eye on that one going forward.
But finally, this one more question about apologists or about whether it's Chinese or China experts. This is always very sensitive because that it's very simple to say everything and everybody in China is bad and everybody in America is good. And I know that I don't want to say that Josh is saying that. And I know that when I was in China, it was difficult to be able to explain what America was up to. The world is a complicated place. There are good things and bad things. And there are great things about China. There are bad things about China. And it's very difficult to have a calm, objective conversation about this. And when you talk about China these days, you can have a conversation either that they're becoming this huge superpower that are going to take over the United States. Well, it's 1.3 billion people with state capitalism that have adopted many of the ways that we are doing just what we wanted them to do. And now they're competing with us. Well, guess what, guys? We've got to compete ourselves. So and as for soft power, which you were just mentioning, Josh, we have a prime example at the university that we have invited the Chinese government through the Confucius Institute, that they are providing language training to our students, in part because that the university was running into financial problems. We could not finance more than 1 year of Chinese language education. Professor Lu Yan and I worked for over 2 decades trying to get the university to finance these things. Well, the money was not there. So the Chinese government comes in. They provide us with teachers. We pay half the deal. They pay half the deal. We're sending more students to Chengdu, and we're having their teachers come to us. This has been a very cooperative relationship. We have more that we have to do at the university. But I think that instead of seeing that that we're being apologists, I think at least at UNH, we're trying to do our best to work with the Chinese and to understand China by sending our students there and getting them to understand more about what's going on.
Josh, thanks so much for that call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. I wanted to ask both of you about something that I noticed when I was preparing for the show. In 2011, President Obama and Chinese President Hu Jintao issued a statement about the pivot, as it's called, in U.S.-Chinese relationship with a growing U.S. presence militarily and in foreign policy circles diplomatically in Asia, and especially seen as a counterweight to China and its growing power. The statement issued by the two presidents said essentially a pledge of cooperation on both sides. China said it was welcoming a growing U.S. role in the Asia-Pacific region, in a sense welcoming that pivot. And the U.S. said it looked forward to China playing a greater role in world affairs. But Lu Yan, the statement versus the way that this has been playing out ever since suggests that each country is actually looking in the opposite direction, that they're not necessarily welcoming these changes as much as they are sort of watching them warily.
Absolutely no. And I think statement is statement, but what each side felt was quite different. By what I watched from Chinese television, which is Chinese state financed television, although it's very much self-sufficient. It's called Chinese Central Television, CCTV. A lot of report recently is about the disputed island called the Diaoyu Island, and in Japanese called the Senkaku. It's very much the historical problem that's not solved, and now it's blow open. And as I looked at this, it's more about the concern about the future, how China could have the access on a kind of a sea route from that area. And of course, it's also Chinese concern about its sovereignty, a very deep, deep issue in modern history, that Chinese sovereignty has always been violated, although not in the second half of the 20th century. But it's a kind of a historical memory that kept in the Chinese mind, both the leadership and the society side. So in this issue, obviously U.S. support to Japanese leadership played a role. The U.S. Asian pivot encouraged certain force within Japan to project power. And it's been a long argument in the political circle in Japan that the peace constitution must be changed. Japan must change its role and exert its power. So it all came into open with the U.S.-Asia pivot.
Let me ask this last question, kind of following up on that, Chris. We know Xi Jinping is set to take charge as China's new president. And also, President Obama is set to travel to Asia to take part in a summit of regional leaders. So as we first hear from this new leader in China, and as we hear the president talking as he sets his priorities for that pivot and for Asia going forward in his second term, what are you going to be listening for as each of them talks about Asia as a whole, but also that unique relationship between the U.S. and China?
Well, first off, I think it's very important that, you know, right after he gets elected, reelected, that President Obama does head to Asia, does to attend. First, he's down in Australia, reinforcing our relationship with our primary military and economic social partner in the South Pacific. And at the Asian summit, he's going to be discussing with not just with Wen Jiabao, the current premier, but also with Putin and all the members there, that Obama realizes that the future of the United States is maybe not as much as in Europe as it is in Asia. And his going there at the beginning of his second term is a marker of this emphasis that he has on Asia.
And we'll just have to leave it there. I want to thank you both for coming in today. Liu Yan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Liu Yan, Associate Professor in the Department of History at the University of New Hampshire. And Chris Reardon, great to talk with you.
Great to see you again.
Chris Reardon is Associate Professor of Political Science and Chair of the Department of Political Science at UNH. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.